Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The producers of this podcast recognise the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present and those emerging.
I must say that the very first inkling of it was when my wife burst into tears on the phone and she had a call from our son who said that a girl he'd been with at Club Bayview in Claremont the night before had been abducted and raped at the local cemetery. Little did I know that the guy who did that crime would go on to become the Claremont serial killer.
Brett Christian is the managing editor and owner of Perth's Post Newspapers, which he established in 1997. The group started with the Subiaco Post, but over the years it's expanded to include the Nedlands, Cottesloe, Mosman Park, Cambridge and Claremont Posts, which means that Brett Christian and his journalists had a front row seat for Australia's longest running criminal investigation, the hunt for the Claremont serial killer.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
After decades of reporting the twists and turns of the investigation, journalist Brett Christian sat through all 95 days of evidence against Bradley Robert Edwards. The trial finally concluded in December 2020. And Brett Christian's excellent book, Stalking Claremont, is available now. Brett joined me to talk about what he now knows about the killer who hid in plain sight for so long, about the macabre trophies he kept from his victims, and in one case, even left in the worst possible location for a family member to discover. But first, Brett takes us back to January 1996, when he first began reporting on what would later become known as the Claremont serial murders.
Sarah Spears, who was the first person to be abducted and the police say murdered, she was treated as a missing person for 2 weeks. I mean, her friends and family knew straight away that there's no way in the world she would just go out and not come home. But, you know, the police get so many missing person calls that they go through their routine that they have to do. And it wasn't until, you know, a couple of weeks later that they put the homicide squad on it.
What year are we talking about?
February, well, late January, Australia Day, in fact, 1996. And it was, so it was into February before a big homicide operation was mounted.
Tell us about Claremont, about the area. What was the vibe?
Well, prior to the abductions and murders, it was very relaxed. I mean, it was a very safe place to be. You know, we went there during the day and it was appeared to be much the same at night, quite safe.
There was one line that you wrote that really resonated with me when you said that it was a place where, say, young women shopped with their mothers during the day and then they went out at nighttime. And I thought, God, that is exactly how I grew up. I grew up in Toowoomba in Queensland, and exactly the same streets where we were with our mums during the day and had grown up, you know, shopping, were the streets we were drinking at night. And it does give you this sense of security, like you know every crack in the street, and it makes you think that nothing bad could ever happen there. That was such a powerful line.
Exactly, yes. You feel at home. It's just, this is your home turf. You recognize every second or third person. And that sense of safety was immense. And when that was shattered by this guy, it made it all the more worse. It just stripped away that sense of safety that we're entitled to have, but more so because had previously been such a safe area.
And there are a couple of photos you had in there from the time, and it's hot, it's sweaty, people are out on the balconies, they're out on the streets drinking, and people walking home because it's warm, it's hard to get a taxi. You made that point that, God, again, that reminded me of my teenage years. People are jumping cabs. You call a cab, you order a cab, it never comes because someone else has jumped in, and they go, are you Michelle? And some man goes, yeah, sure. You know, someone grabs you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So your cab never comes. So we used to do this too. You walk towards your home thinking, hopefully I'll get a cab on the way. Sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. Next minute you know you're at home.
Yeah, because you've got not a care in the world. You're young, you're bulletproof, and not only do you feel completely safe, but your friends don't feel bad about leaving without you. That was a really common theme I had talking to sort of contemporaries of those young women, was that, you know, if you're in the sort of the rough part of town, there's no way you would leave on your own or let your friend leave on their own. But it was Claremont, who, you know, nothing's going to happen. So if someone would drift off into the night and no one would give it, you know, a second thought.
No, you assume they've met up with other people that they know or whatever, they've headed home.
Exactly, got a lift. Yeah. Sarah Spears was only 18 and she was a cool girl. She'd been to boarding school in the area and very familiar with it. And she was doing what a lot of them do, which is leapfrog for taxis. So what you just described, she'd got, rather than call a cab from the club, she walked 500 metres to where there was a phone booth on the corner, because no one had mobile phones then, or very few people did. So she called a taxi from the phone booth and then crossed the road and waited. And the taxi only took 2 or 3 minutes at the most to arrive. And when he got there, she wasn't there. Nobody was there. She vanished into the night. It was like she'd entered a fourth dimension.
Which, again, for the taxi driver wasn't strange because, you know, it was frustrating for them as well, wasn't it? Quite often they arrive and the person isn't there because the person's jumped in another cab. So he didn't think anything of it, I'm assuming.
Exactly. He went around the block and picked up another fare.
Yeah. And Sarah, I didn't realise that she'd been a boarder at boarding school, so she's a very independent person. Even less likely that her friends would have been surprised when they didn't know where she was for a few hours.
Exactly, and she was very safety conscious. She was a country girl who sent to the city to board, and her sister, her big sister, was at school with her, and she lived with her sister in a unit her father had bought them, and they were very close. And it was her sister who raised the alarm. She walked into the police station and reported her little sister missing. You can imagine what went through her mind.
Yeah, and again, as you were saying, that's that frustrating situation a lot of families find themselves in when they're saying to police, we're telling you she's not wandered off, she's not with friends, whatever, we know this woman. And police are saying, come on, she's only been missing a couple of hours. You know, she's probably with a friend or a boyfriend or whatever.
Mm.
And they knew, no, there's something wrong, didn't they, very quickly.
Especially when she didn't turn up for work. She was very responsible.
Of course, now we know that there had been not only the very serious, terrifying sexual assault in the cemetery 12 months before, but there'd actually been a lot of sort of creepy events, hadn't there, around the Claremont area?
There had been, and that was the thing that really knocked me flat when I discovered that, because there'd been close to 40 incidents where women had been attacked walking home, just as we were talking about before. And the police, many, many years later, well into this century, they linked 21 of those to the disappeared and murdered young women. But at the time, they didn't. The police just thought, oh, this stuff happens to these girls. There was, you know, as the editor of the local paper, I would have expected the local cops to have said, look, there's bad stuff happening to women out there. We're going to mount an operation to try to catch him. Or could you please put out a warning to young women to make sure they travel in pairs or get someone to pick them up or whatever? But that never happened. And that's I think it's really, really frightening.
Was it on the grapevine, though? Was it at least spoken about among young people that there's some creep out there who's, like, exposing himself to women, who's attacking women, who's trying to drag them into cars? Did women know that?
No, they did, but nobody put them together. No, nobody. People just assumed that there were a lot of creepy blokes around.
Mm.
It wasn't until much later when the police really went and did a trawl through all the files and all the reports that they realised first of all, the description of the bloke quite often, you know, had common characteristics, but also what he was doing was common as well.
I tell you, the most amazing thing about your book to me, and it comes at very early in the book, and this is not a spoiler, is that for so many years we lived with the spectre of this amazing mystery in Perth, in Claremont. Who is this person? Who could it be? You know, he's a phantom. And yet in your book you expose the fact that he was, like, right there in plain sight, and the fact that he was driving a Telstra van was even noticed really early on. Like, how did he remain a mystery? How was that missed for so long?
He was incredibly lucky. I mean, that, you know, it's looking behind the scenes to the police investigation. It was amazing how lucky he was and how often the investigation veered towards him, especially the Telstra link, and then veered away from him again. And that was largely because the police became fixated on another bloke or other people. And, you know, they were looking over here when they should have been looking over there. And what I also discovered was he was looking back at them. He was striking up conversations with his friends about the Claremont murders to see how they viewed them.
One of those guys.
Yeah. And the other creepy thing about him is that he doesn't look creepy.
Yeah.
I mean, I sat in a trial for 7 months and looked at him a lot. And his sheer ordinariness is what is really disconcerting. You know, I've seen artist drawings of him with all these lines on his face and looking really sinister, but he doesn't look sinister at all. That's rubbish. He's got this sort of now sort of roundish, sort of fattish face. He was quite good looking in his 20s. I've managed to snare one picture of him from back there, but he does not look. He just looks like an ordinary bloke you would look twice at in the street. You know, with Ivan Milat, you can sort of imagine him as a really creepy, horrible, sinister serial killer. But this guy, Ivan Milat, drove around, you know, Double Bay or Toorak in a Telstra car. No one would probably get in. But this guy, no problem.
But even Ivan managed to charm young European people into his truck.
That's true. He did, yes, yeah.
But this man we're talking about, Bradley Edwards, you're quite right. When he was a younger man, he was quite handsome. And I guess you have to be at least ordinary looking to get close enough to women to be able to abduct them. I mean, we know that he crept up on some women literally in the dark, but in other cases he must have coerced them into his van, do you think?
Yes, I'm not sure how he did that. I think most likely they were a bit befuddled and really anxious to get a cab and probably mistook it for a cab. Yeah, the Telstra logo, and, you know, there's markings on the side, there's something on the roof. Or they did recognise it as a Telstra car and thought, oh, this is a bloke out doing his night shift, he's going the same way I am, that's not a problem.
It does seem extraordinary that a person, it's probably a very naive thing to say, but it does seem extraordinary that a person would commit crimes like this in their work car. You know, I kind of think I might trust it too.
Exactly. And that again is shows how lucky he was, because there were three young men who basically witnessed the abduction of Kira Glennon on Stirling Highway. And one of them was a Holden nut, and he knew everything about this really boring model Holden. I mean, it seemed a really strange thing to obsess about. But he even knew that it had, this car had the wrong hubcaps for that model on. So the police had that, I thought, red-hot clue, and there were only 600 station wagons of that colour sold in Perth. But a matter of finding the one that had the wrong hubcap, they would have had him.
But they didn't.
They didn't, because they began to focus on the wrong guy, and they shut down that part of the investigation.
So Jane Rimmer was the next woman who went missing. What were the circumstances around her disappearance?
Well, she was out with a group of girlfriends, and they were sort of careening between Club Bayview and the Claremont Hotel. And she had, at closing time of the Claremont Hotel, she made a sudden decision not to travel home with them. And she was last seen by a revolving closed-circuit television camera virtually right above her on the footpath outside the Claremont Hotel, and she was interacting with this guy that he's become known as Mystery Man, and obviously sharing a joke with him. But because the camera was revolving, and we're talking about the mid-90s now, the different technology, it missed her leaving, because it didn't show who she left with, if anybody, and what direction she went. So that was the last confirmed sighting of her. And her body was found about 2 months later, a good hour's drive south of Perth.
So there's that vision of her, black and white, patchy image of her chatting with a man, a tall man. He looks like a youngish man, and she's laughing, beautiful, big laugh with this guy as she's leaving the premises. And famously, that footage wasn't released at the time. Police released it much, much later. And the man never came forward. He's still never come forward, even though the killer has been found. And we know that that is not him. That's not the killer in the footage, right?
Well, we don't know.
Oh, okay.
I know people who think he looks similar.
Okay.
I don't know the guy well enough. I've not seen him from behind. But there's a school of thought that it's possible that it's the same bloke. Whoever it is has never come forward. But as you said, the police didn't release that for 12 years after it happened. So, I mean, any chance of anyone who knew him coming forward or having the memory of being out that night or the guy being overseas or in hospital or in jail far too much time had passed. And even when they did release it, the lead never went anywhere.
I mean, we know from experience that they have their reasons for not releasing all the information that they have at the time, and oftentimes it does pay dividends to not. So who knows what the thinking was?
Of course, yeah. And of course they hold back information deliberately, because you get false confessions. You get some people who are weird people who think it's a good idea to say that they've committed murders when they haven't. And that's the only way you can find out is to keep back some details.
Thank you to our wonderful patrons for helping us keep Australian true crime alive and independent. This week, we'd like to thank James O'Connor, Ellie Wilkinson, Susan Bellamy, Carol Deanne, Deb Curtis, and James Batson. You might have noticed you can now also make a one-off contribution to Australian true crime if you'd rather not become an ongoing patron. There's a link to do that in our show notes. We're independent podcast producers, which means that unlike most of the other shows in the top 20, we're not backed by a major media company. It really is just us. The great thing about that is that we don't have any corporate overlords telling us what we can and can't say. The bad thing is that we don't have any of their money either. So any way you can support us as independent producers is very much appreciated. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Coming up on Australian True Crime, journalist Brett Christian tells us about the tragic parallels between the Claremont serial killer case and another case we covered recently on this show. But first, I wondered if the murders and sexual assaults carried out by Bradley Robert Edwards turned out to coincide with stressful events in his private life, as often tends to be the case with serial offenders.
Well, the crimes certainly coincided with stress periods in his own life. The Karakata abduction, the cemetery abduction and rape was when his first marriage was seen to be falling apart. His wife gave evidence in court, actually, that he was getting more and more distant, and that we now know he was out in his Telstra car, lying in wait for a poor innocent 17-year-old. Which he admitted to, when Sarah Spears was abducted. Now, he's not been convicted of that murder, so I need to be a bit careful. But the prosecution alleged that when, at the time she was abducted, there was a huge blow-up at his home. His wife had introduced Edwards to a lodger who came and stayed with him, and the lodger began secretly having sex with her, and the household blew apart. Basically, his wife left, and then she notified him that she was pregnant to the lodger, and very soon after that, Jane Rimmer disappeared. A year later, when Kira Glennon disappeared, he had just very recently broken up with another woman he had met and had a sort of heated relationship with. So the question you ask is, I guess, do these events cause a person who's inclined to be a serial killer to snap and go out and commit a crime? Well, there's certainly a coincidence of events in this case, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then Kiara Glennon has long been considered the last victim of the Claremont serial killer. Do you think she was? And if so, why did he stop offending? And did he stop, do you think, offending in terms of the other offences that we think that he was committing, like flashing and sexual assaults and all those things? What happened in his life after Kiara Glennon?
Well, he met another woman and eventually married her, and she had a child when he met her. And he, to all outward appearances, he became an ordinary suburban family man with a good job, and he was progressing up the ladder at Telstra and still drove Whitehall and Commodore station wagons around. I think one of the very telling things that I sort of talk about in the book is that there was a professor called David Barclay, a British professor who came out as part of a review group, and he surmised way back in 2004, he said, if the person who has been doing this may well have stopped because his last victim fought back and fought back furiously and made, may have given him a hell of a fright. And we now know that Keira Glennon did fight back. She was only a tiny girl in stature, but boy, she was feisty in nature. And in the act of fighting back, of course, she dragged some DNA from his skin. And that's why he's in jail now.
Really?
Yes, yeah. And many years later, a traces of Edward's DNA was found under her left thumbnail. And that was kept in the fridge from the time of her autopsy in 1997 until two police sergeants began to review the whole case. They said, let's just start from the beginning and do this all again. We've got all of those years of work. Let's make sure it was done properly from the start. And they, within a couple of weeks, they discovered this crucial sample sitting in a fridge.
Isn't that amazing? Fresh eyes, just fresh eyes on the file.
Exactly, yeah. And look, he'd still be walking the streets without those two cops. It's an amazing, amazing bit of work. And once they had that, of course, they then realised that something that they had not connected, which was the cemetery abduction and rape, was actually the same guy, because obviously they had DNA from that crime, but they didn't have it. They had not matched it with any of the murder ones, and all of a sudden they were able to make a match. So then they knew that if we find this rapist, we've got the Claremont killer.
So they then focused on that rape from so many years ago.
Yes, they refocused on it. They had a couple of goes at linking them, but they became so convinced that this other guy had done it that they thought there can't be a link because his DNA didn't match the cemetery crime. So they put that to one side, and it wasn't until they made this DNA hit, which absolutely connected those two crimes, that they realised they were dealing with the same offender.
That's unbelievable. So in the end, he was convicted of Jane Rimmer and Keira Glennon's murders, but not of Sarah Spears because I don't know if it's solely because, but Sarah Spears' remains have still never been found, right?
That's right, yes, yeah. And the judge made a very telling comment in his judgment. His exact words I don't recall, but he said basically it's likely that Edwards was the killer of Sarah Spears, but there was no evidence there was not sufficient evidence to show that. There was evidence. There was evidence of three young men in a car who looked behind them. We're going back to this phone box incident where Sarah Spears called a cab, crossed the road, waited for a cab. There were two cars actually in the street before the cab arrived, and in the front car were three young blokes, who one of whom looked back and saw a car appear to respond to this woman. They saw Sarah sitting on the or standing on the curb, and one of them became worried. He thought this car may be picking her up, and actually made a remark in the car. But he also described the headlights of this car as being square. Now, the car Edwards was driving at the time, a different Telstra car, had square headlights. So there's a little bit of evidence, and also there was a similar car seen in Mosman Park, which is only probably about a seven-minute drive from Claremont, accompanied by really white, terrible, blood-curdling screams. So the person who heard these screams saw a station wagon like similar to the one that Edwards was driving at the time. So there was evidence put forward to support him as the murderer of Sarah Spears, but the judge in the end dismissed it. He said there was reasonable doubt that was the person.
God, what a blow for her parents. Are they still living?
They are, yes. Yeah, I remember turning around and watching and having a look at them, their faces when that happened. They were devastated. They were puzzled to start with. How could this be? But they've been through a terrible time, and they still have not seen justice. I mean, the other parents have seen justice, but I mean, it doesn't take the grief away.
No. And also, now the three young men in that car, in that story, from memory, wasn't
at least one of them said, should we go back and check? And then they said no, and we didn't. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right, yes.
Yeah. Did he or they give evidence during the trial, or was that read into evidence?
I think all three gave evidence.
They did?
Yes. Yeah.
I think about them a lot.
Yes, all the what ifs, you know. And you can't live your life coulda, woulda, shoulda. But really, that was one that they must really regret.
Yeah, I can't imagine living with that for the rest of your life. I mean, having that really responsible impulse too, which a lot of us wouldn't have even had, to be honest, and then not following it through. I can't imagine that. In your book, you talk about so many revelations, and that's why this episode of our podcast is not a spoiler in any way and shouldn't deter anyone from reading your book, because the details are incredible, disturbing to say the least. Things like the fact that the killer, Bradley Edwards, visited Kiara Glennon's grave, detectives believe, 3 years after her death and left behind an item of her underwear.
That is really, really creepy, isn't it?
That's dark.
That's dark, yeah. It's jaw-dropping. And, of course, that set me off to do some research, and it's not unknown. It's actually not all that weird. Well, it's weird. It certainly is weird, but it's not all that unusual.
Like uncommon.
Uncommon, yeah. I often think, you know, if you wrote that book as fiction, people just say, this is rubbish. This can never happen. This person has got a ridiculous imagination, but it all happened.
Well, again, Ivan Milat's garage was full of trophies, wasn't it?
Yes.
Full of the belongings of his victims. But to visit her grave and leave that there, it's like, what were you hoping, that her family would find that? Or who did find that? How was that discovered?
A member of her family who was visiting the grave, yeah.
A member of her family?
A member of her family, yes, yeah. And, of course, this guy visited multiple times. It wasn't just once. And that's how the police operation went, because they set up CCTV cameras in the cemetery and eventually hid in the cemetery behind the tombstones, hoping he'd come back. He was coming back at regular intervals, sometimes with a woman.
No.
So that is super creepy.
And who did she think they were visiting, and, like, what did she think was happening, this woman?
That is a mystery. It's a puzzle, which unfortunately, I haven't got to the bottom of. Mm. But, yeah, it's jaw-dropping stuff, isn't it? It's you can't think what was going on in these people's minds.
No. Do you think anyone in his life ever had an inkling, a suspicion, ever wondered?
Well, his second wife made a couple of very cryptic comments during her evidence and was prevented from going on. You know, she said, at one stage, she was in fear of her life from him just before she left him. She made some comments like that and was stopped by the judge after objections from Edward's defence lawyer. Now, that says to me that I guess these paths that the ex-wife was going to go down had been explored in a pre-trial conference, and that the judge had ruled that they be excluded. Edward's lawyer described them as editorialising. They were not facts. It was just her telling how she felt, and that's not a fact. But to me, it was absolutely fascinating.
I noticed that he was given a 40-year minimum sentence, which at his age, how old is he now?
He's 52, so...
So it's likely to die in prison. But does WA have a no-body, no-parole law?
They do, yes, they do. But, of course, he was not convicted of the murder of Sarah Spears, so that doesn't actually apply in this case.
Not yet, unless they could get a conviction for that. Do you know if they're still attempting to? Is there any mood to try and get a conviction in that case?
The police have said very firmly they're still very, it's still a very active investigation. Still investigating it. And they plan to talk to Edwards in jail about it.
How's he been since conviction in terms of cooperation and things like that? Do you know? Do you know what sort of prisoner he is?
Look, he's in isolation. He's the last I heard, he was, which was not very long ago, he's got his own unit, own room and a little exercise area, and doesn't interact. He's certainly not in the general population of the prison, put it that way. Other prisoners know him, so he must have some contact, but he's kept in cotton wool, especially after an apparent suicide attempt. during the preliminary hearings.
I've been to Perth, but I don't know Perth intimately. Is it the sort of place where everybody knows somebody connected to the case?
Exactly, yes. Yeah, everyone's got an anecdote. For instance, Kira Glennon, you know, she was very outgoing. She had lots of school friends, lots of university friends, lots of work colleagues. Same with the other two young women. You know, Sarah Spears was really just 18-year-old, just starting out, just had loads of friends, very popular, outgoing young woman, whole life ahead of her. Joan Rimmer, the same. She was very outgoing, very friendly, you know, lots of mates. So the connections are, you know, they say most cities have 6 degrees of separation, and that Perth has 1.5, and I think that's about right.
Yeah, and they also say that the ripple effect of violent crime is, you know, I think there's 12 or 15 people directly affected or something like that. So by the time we factor in their parents, their siblings, their best friends, all of those intimates, really close connections of them who still live probably in the area and whose lives have been marked by the trauma of these events, you know, that's a lot of people, isn't it, in a small community like Perth?
Oh, it sure is, yes, yeah. It's had a permanent effect, and hopefully, you know, lessons have been learned by everybody, you know, by the community, by the police, by the media. I think the media's got needs to do a bit of navel gazing too. The way they went along with this this rubbish about the, you know, these other suspects, you know, they basically crucified a couple of people and they were in the media. We didn't. I made myself very unpopular by being a skeptic. You know, I think there are real lessons to be learned there.
Well, yeah, speaking of trauma, let's talk about their lives, these men who were suspected and treated as people of interest. We recently talked about Eric Edgar Cook and that fantastic series on Stan, After the Night. Of course, there were two men who were wrongly convicted for some of his crimes. Their lives were destroyed.
Look, I know both of them pretty well because I've written a book about that case as well. It's called Presumed Guilty, and it's in two halves. One half's about basically a biography of Daryl Beamish. He was a young deaf guy who was stitched up for a murder that Eric Cook had done, and the other guy, and that was a horrific murder of a 22-year-old woman, a Melbourne socialite, in her flat. She was asleep in her flat, and she was attacked with a tomahawk and a pair of scissors.
Mm, that's right. Her genitals were attacked with a tomahawk, weren't they?
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. So that was a terrible story. And and the other one was John Button, whose fiance Rosemary Anderson was deliberately run down by Eric Cook in a stolen car. And John happened on the scene just afterwards and got busted for killing her. So both went to jail. Daryl Beamish, would you believe, was sentenced to hang for that crime. He could have been executed easily.
On the back of his confession, which was clearly constructed by police.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah,
it's terrible.
Yep, they wrote out a confession and made him copy it. They're still with us. Daryl Beamish is still living a quite a simple but happy life well south of Perth, goes fishing. Fixes up junk he finds on the verge and sells it to help his income. He's very happily married. He's now in his late 70s. John Button is also married, has two lovely kids, adults, and he now lives actually just outside of Canberra, at Orange in New South Wales.
So what of the two men who were, or three men you were telling us about, who were looked at very closely for these crimes, these crimes in Claremont?
Well, it ruined all their lives. It's as simple as that. They went from being, you know, ordinary people going about their business to targets, being targeted as serial killers, and having their names and images, you know, blasted all over the media as being called prime suspects or persons of interest. And there were three, in fact. The main one was a public servant called Lance Williams, who lived in Cottesloe, which is only a few minutes' drive from Claremont. And they had good reason to, you know, to focus on him, because he was driving around his car after midnight, well after midnight, and looking at young women walking home. And on one occasion, he in fact circulated the block 30 times and drove past it. So they had good reason. They had undercover police out there looking for, you know, curb crawlers and anyone who might be suspicious. And they picked him up. And they became more and more convinced that he was the killer and had somehow managed to conceal every forensic trace of what he'd done. Turned out not to be true. But they did all sorts of things. They tracked his car, you know, electronically. They bugged his car and his office and his home. He expended a huge thousands and thousands of man hours and millions of dollars, probably $20 million, in tracking him. And at the same time, all those resources were not being used to find the real killer. You know, one of them was the mayor of Claremont, Peter Wagers, who was shockingly treated. He lost his job as mayor. He was taken as a child psychologist in schools, taken out of contact with children, still is, still works there, but still is. Still, and he's had a series of heart attacks. He attributes to PTSD as a result of the police surveillance. Lance Williams is dead. He died at the age of 60. Others say he was hounded to death and that his illness was caused by, you know, by the stress of being hauled in and repeatedly questioned and publicly had the finger pointed at him. I know his parents' lives were turned upside down. You know, his mother stopped going to, you know, social functions, and they stopped going out because, you know, people firmly believed that their son was a serial killer. The ripples of sort of a wrongful accusation or a wrongful conviction, and you can never erase them. You can never erase people's suspicions. Peter Wagers puts it quite well. He said people might now know that I'm not a serial killer because they've now caught the person who is, but they still think I must be the sort of person who's bad enough that the police thought I might have been. You know, so you can, it's a real trap, a real catch-22 trap.
There is much, much more that we haven't covered in Brett Christian's excellent book, Stalking Claremont, which is available now. His book about Perth's first serial killer and the two men wrongly convicted of his crimes is called Presumed Guilty, and it's also available now. You can still stream the four-part documentary series about that case on Stan. It's called After the Night, and in episode 186 of Australian True Crime, you can hear from the writer-director of that series, Thomas Meadmore. Thank you to patrons Erin Heer, Jodie Corrigan, Lisa Samuels, Carmel Dugan, Samantha Nixon, and Josephine Walsh. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.
This has been another Smartfella production in conjunction with the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned, We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Listen to this Acast show ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.